Cryon gave the shortest parable ever, and the one that summarizes how, when we change ourselves, it changes everything. This was also one of the first parables ever given in front of a group.
Imagine yourself, along with many other human beings, in a tar pit covered with tar. Dirty from head to foot, unable to move quickly from place to place because the tar is so thick. As you plod from place to place, you become used to this condition. And year after year, your life is lived in this fashion, along with the others. Like the gravity of the planet, the encumbrance of the tar is simply accepted, a fact of life for all. This is your imagined state. Suddenly, but quietly, you are offered a gift from God. It's a magic tool that cleans your body and keeps it clean even while you are in the tar. Like an energy field, it actually repels the tar as you walk through it. You accept the gift and the work that must go with it, and you begin to learn how to use it. Slowly you change. To others, you are beginning to stand out, for you are different, fresh and clean, while they are moving around you still in the dark tar. You begin to realize how you have co-created this for yourself, but you also realize that it was a very personal gift, so you say nothing. Now, do you think the others around you will ignore you as you walk freely without the tar touching you or encumbering your feet? They will watch the tar touch your body and never soil you. What do you think will happen? Ah, watch. They are about to change. The first thing that will happen is that wherever you walk, there will be space, for they will clear the way for you. The second thing that will happen is that they will ask you how such a thing is possible. And when they find the magic tool from God, each of them will begin using it for themselves, and more humans will also be clean. Each person creating for him or for herself personally, just as you did for yourself. As you silently continue your life over a period of time, look at what is happening to those around you. More than half of them will be clean and unencumbered by the tar. Stop and think about what has really happened. You have not evangelized your gift or asked any of these people to change for you. Yet they changed anyway. This is how the result of just the one creates for the many. We tell you, dear ones, that when you change yourself, it is the beginning of change all around you. Humans cannot be still when they see peace and love emanating from you. It is disarming and loving all at the same time, like a magnet among other magnets. Your new polarity will eventually have an effect on the alignment of everyone around you, and your existence will never be the same.
Take a look at this short parable, which contains some of the clearest answers about the workings of New Age energy on the planet. In this parable, Cryon has humans in a tar pit, covered with tar, dirty from head to foot, unable to move quickly from place to place because the tar is so thick. This is how we are in normal life in the old energy, chained by old karmic lessons and walking the best we can as we carry it all around with us. Cryon then offers five words that are part of his cosmic humor. He says, "This is your imagined state." This is Cryon's way of reminding us all that the Earth's experience is not reality, and that our duality is a phantom. The real universe is what we experience when we are not here. In the parable, the magic tools from God are the new energy gifts that Cryon speaks about. Suddenly, as you receive the gifts, the tar no longer sticks to you, and you walk around unencumbered and clean. This is a strong reference to how the New Age energy affects you. You are no longer held to karmic contracts, and you can move forward on the planet toward a marriage with your higher self and eventual ascension, a graduate status. Cryon also casually mentions that we have co-created this magic tool. Wait a minute. I thought the magic tool was from God, you might say. Again, Crine wants us to remember that he calls us pieces of God, walking the earth in lesson. In other words, we represent the wholeness and love of God. Next, he has us walking around in this state without the tar touching us, indicating that not only has our old karma been dispersed, but so too the karmic ties with those who had the opportunity to interact with ours. This, of course, is the object of the parable, to show how our decisions create changes on a larger scale than just for us in our own little worlds. Crayon goes on to describe what happens to those around us. This really is an important concept, for it addresses New Age energy and gifts from God. Will we lose our mates, our kids, our jobs, and so on if we take on the New Age energy gifts? Will we be outcasts? Listen to what the parable says. Do you think others around you will ignore you as you walk freely without the tar touching you or encumbering your feet? The first thing is that everyone will notice that you are different, but instead of casting you out, the opposite potential exists. Others will look at how you are living and respond. Some will want the same thing and ask what happened to you, and some will just be glad that you changed. As far as mates and kids, they will see the changes in you first, and they will wonder what has taken place to make you suddenly such a great balanced person. When you're balanced spiritually, physically, and mentally, a wonderful thing happens. Everyone wants to be your friend. People recognize the specialness of who you are, and they are not threatened by you in any way. Can you see how this attitude would enhance a job, a marriage, a friendship, or a generation cap, and not destroy it? The only ones you will offend are those who are angry at you for having changed. And believe me, those are the ones that you don't want around you anyway. When it is all said and done, even though you might be the only one who decides to accept the new energy ways, dozens around you will be affected by your choice. This is part of the way God uses individual choices by humans to create energy that will benefit many. Perhaps you can see the dynamics of this concept and truly understand how an individual decision for enlightenment is far more important than it appears. Woe and the Rooms of Lesson. I told you I would share my favorites with you, and this is one of them. Although this parable was one of the first ones given by Crayon, it remains strong in relevance to our daily lives. Crayon's entire thrust is to give us the tools to raise our own vibration on this planet, to be everything possible while we are here. This parable has much hidden within it that lets us actually see the possibilities we have before us. It also tugs at our hearts and asks us to remember who we really are.
There once was a human whom we will call Woe. Woe's gender is not important to this story, but since you do not have an adequate word for a neutral gender person, we call the human Woe, to encompass a man called Woe or a woman. However, for the sake of translation only, we will say that Woe is a him. Like all humans in his culture, Woe lived in a house. But Woe was really only concerned with the room that he lived in, since it was uniquely his own. His room was beautiful, and he was charged with keeping it that way, which he did. Woe lived a good life. He was in a culture where he never wanted for food, for it was plentiful. He was also never cold, for he always had cover. As Woe grew up, he learned many things about himself. He learned which things made him feel happy. And he would find objects to hang on the wall that he could look at, which also made him feel happy. Woe also learned which things made him feel sad. And he learned how to hang these things on the wall when he wished to be sad. Woe also learned things which made him angry. And he found things to drag out and place on the wall that he could turn to when he chose to be angry. As was the case with other humans, Woe had many fears. Even though he had the basics in life, he feared other humans and certain situations. He feared those humans and situations that could bring change, for he felt secure and stable with the way things were, and he had worked hard to get to that state. So Woe feared the situations that seemingly had control over his stable room, and he also feared the humans who controlled these situations. He learned about God from other humans. They told him that being a human was a very small thing, and Woe believed it. After all, he looked around him and he saw millions of humans, but only one God. He was told that God was everything and that he was nothing, but that God in his infinite love would answer Woe's prayers if he prayed in earnest and had integrity during his life. So Woe, being a spiritual person, prayed to God that the humans and situations he feared would not create changes so that his room could remain the same. And God answered Woe's request. Woe feared the past, for somehow it reminded him of unpleasant things. So he prayed to God to block those things from his memory. And God answered Woe's request. Woe also feared the future, for it contained potential for change and was dark, uncertain, and hidden from him. Woe prayed to God that the future would not bring change to his room, and God answered his request. Woe never ventured very far into his room, for all he really needed as a human was in one corner. When his friends came to visit, this is the corner he showed to them, and he was satisfied with this arrangement. Woe first noticed motion in the other corner when he was about 26. It frightened him severely, and he immediately prayed to God for it to go away, for it suggested that he was not alone in his room, and this was not an acceptable condition. God answered Woe's request, and the motion stopped, so Woe did not fear it anymore. And when he was 34, it returned again, and Woe asked that it be stopped, for he was very afraid. The motion stopped, but not before Woe saw something he had missed completely in the corner. Another door. On the door was strange writing, and Woe feared its implications. Woe asked religious leaders about the strange door and the motion, and they warned him not to go near it, for they said it was the door of death, and he would certainly die if his curiosity became action. They also told him that the writing on the door was evil, and that he should never look upon it again. Instead, they encouraged him to participate in ritual with them and to give of his talent and earnings to the group. And by doing so, they told him he would fare well. When Woe was 42, the motion again returned. Although Woe wasn't as afraid of it this time, he again asked for it to stop, and it did. God was good to answer so completely and quickly. Woe felt empowered by the results of his prayers. When Woe was 50, he became ill and died, although he wasn't really aware of it when it happened. He noticed the motion again in the corner and again prayed for it to stop, but instead it became clearer and came closer. In fear, Woe arose from his bed only to discover that his earth body remained and he was in spirit form. As the motion came closer, Woe started to somehow recognize it. He was curious instead of frightened, and his spirit body seemed somehow natural. Woe now saw that the motion was actually two entities who approached. The white figures, as they drew closer, gleamed as though they had light from within. Finally, they stood before him, and Woe was astounded by their majesty, but he wasn't afraid. One of the figures spoke to Woe and said, "Come, dear one, it's time to go." The figure's voice was filled with gentleness and familiarity. Without hesitation, Woe went with the two. He was starting to remember how familiar all this was as he looked behind him and saw his carcass seemingly asleep on the bed. He was filled with a wonderful feeling that he could not explain. One of the entities took his hand and led him directly toward the door with a strange writing on it. The door opened, and all three went through it. Woe found himself in a long hallway with doors to rooms on each side. He thought to himself, "This is indeed a far larger house than I had imagined." Woe noticed the first door with more odd writing on it. He spoke to one of the white ones, "What's in this door to the right?" Without a word, the white figure opened the door and motioned for Woe to enter. As Woe did so, he was amazed. Stacked from floor to ceiling were riches beyond his wildest dreams. There were gold bars, pearls, diamonds. In one corner alone, there were enough rubies and precious stones for an entire kingdom. He looked at his white glowing companions and asked, "What is this place?" The larger white one replied, "This is your room of abundance, had you wish to enter it. It belongs to you even now, and will remain here for you in the future." Woe was startled by this information. As they returned to the hallway, Woe asked, "What was in the first room to the left?" Another door with writing that was somehow starting to make sense. As the white one approached the door, he said to Woe, "This is your room of peace, had you wish to use it." Woe entered the room with his friends, only to be surrounded by a thick white fog. The fog seemed to be alive, for it immediately encased his body, and Woe breathed it in. He was overwhelmed with comfort, and he knew he would never be afraid again. He felt peace where there had never been any before. He wanted to stay, but his companions motioned for him to continue, and they again started down the long hallway. There was still another door on the left. "What is this room?" Woe asked. "It is a place where only you can go," said the smaller white figure. Woe entered the room and was immediately filled with a gold light. He knew what this was. This was Woe's self-essence, his enlightenment, his knowledge of past and future. This was Woe's storehouse of spirit and love. Woe wept with joy, and he stood absorbing truth and understanding for a very long time. His companions did not come in. They were patient. Finally, Woe again stepped into the hallway. He had changed. He looked at his companions and he recognized them. "You are the angel guides," Woe stated matter-of-factly. "No," said the large one. "We are your angel guides." In perfect love, they continued, "We have been here since your birth for only one reason, to love you and help show you the doorway. You were afraid and asked us to retreat, and we did. We are in service to you in love, and we honor your incarnation of expression." Woe felt no reprimand in their words. He realized they were not in judgment of him, but in honor of him, and he felt their love. Woe looked at the doors and was now able to read the writing. As he was led down the hallway, there were doors marked Healing, Contract, and another marked Joy. Woe saw even more than he had wished, for down the line there were doors with names of unborn children, and even one marked World Leader. Woe began to realize what he had missed, and as they knew his thoughts, the guide said, "Do not be reproachful with your spirit, for it is inappropriate and does not serve your magnificence." Woe did not fully understand. He looked back down the hallway from where he had first entered and saw the writing on the door, the writing that had originally frightened him. The writing was a name. It was his name, his real name, and he now fully understood. Woe knew the routine, for now he remembered everything, and he was no longer Woe. He said goodbye to his guides and thanked them for their faithfulness. He stood for a long time looking at them and loving them. Then he turned to walk toward the light at the end of the hallway. He had been there before. He knew what was waiting for him on his brief 3-day trip to the Cave of Creation to retrieve his essence, and then on to the Hall of Honor and Celebration, where those who had loved him dearly were waiting for him, including those who he had loved and lost while on Earth. He knew where he had been, and he knew where he was going. Wo was going home.
The introduction of the character Wo by Kryon in the early stages of storytelling is an attempt at creating a person with no gender. Wo is a Wo-man. Which is it? Woman or man? It is Kryon's intent to avoid creating a gender slant to interfere with your full understanding of the parable or your ability to put yourself in Wo's place. In the parable, Wo's home is obviously his life, or his expression, as Kryon calls a lifetime on Earth. The analogy of the various rooms refers to the windows of opportunity we all get, which come along with our contract, our karma, and therefore our potential while we are here. The part about Wo learning what makes him happy, sad, and angry, and then hanging things on the wall to make him feel that way, is really insightful information about humans. It refers to the parts of ourselves that dig into the past and revisit events in order to feel a certain way. Usually, it's not appropriate, enlightened behavior, since it dredges up old memories so that we can feel anger, hate, vindictiveness, and victimization. Sometimes, it's just good old wishing to be in a place that makes us happy, such as when we were growing up. The fact that Kryon said that Wo placed things on the wall for this purpose was also meaningful. When you come into my home, the items on the wall are for all to see. They are my family photos and works of beauty. What this means is that I have placed things on the wall to give them emphasis, even for the benefit of strangers who come in, because I feel that these items are special. Therefore, Kryon has Wo hanging his feelings up for everyone to see and react to on his wall of lesson. Wo, like so many humans, wants to involve others in his own process, since it makes him feel better to do so. Wo doesn't know about responsibility yet. Even so, later on we learn that no matter what stage Wo is at in the Enlightenment department, there is no judgment from God about it, ever. We see that Wo has fears, and his main one is about control. It seems that in his life he fears the situation where someone could change his room, his life. His reaction to most of these fears is to stay the same. His real fear, therefore, is change. And he longs for stability, or a static awareness. He also fears the past, but he doesn't know why. He turns to other humans to learn about God, and he uses what he learns to protect himself from change. This is an excellent example of what religion is teaching today. We have God playing the role of responsible protector from evil, and church members are encouraged to follow the shepherd's protection through the valley of the shadow of death. This hardly encourages empowering spiritual thought from individuals, nor does it promote the concept of taking responsibility for what happens to you, as Kryon has advised us we might consider. The wonderful part of this story is that even though Wo buys into the average, normal kind of religious doctrine, he gets results from his prayers. He receives the protection he asks for, and he is indeed shielded from change and from the disturbing motion in the corner. Again, Kryon has told us that the mechanics of the Spirit of God are absolute, and that the loving energy of good, prayerful intent yields results. Remember the adage, "Be careful what you ask for, you might get it?" It's true, and this parable is the proof. We all get various chances for empowerment and self-discovery in every lifetime, and Wo got his. Even though he felt he had satisfactory answers, God honored him with a poke from his guides. This was the irritating motion he saw in the corner, along with his vision of a door there. It was his guide's efforts to bring him into another reality, thereby giving him his deserved opportunity for change and a chance to face his fear. It was again insightful of Kryon to show what the religions of the day told him to do about it. Wo was told that the motion was evil. To this day, This is the most often quoted answer for anything contrary to popular doctrine, no matter what the religious belief. Many who disagree with another's point of view simply call it evil and never truly address any of the messages or look at the energy that surrounds the belief. So Woe finally died, and the thing he feared the most happened. The motion in the corner became reality. But he somehow recognized it and was not frightened. We go on to see the various rooms beyond the door, and we share in Woe's discovery. The room tour is an exposure of his earthly contract, the one he made for himself, and along the way his potential enlightenment. With riches, peace, and personal inner essence of individual power, his peace of God. He recognizes his guides along the way, showing us that we know who our guides really are, but we have this hidden from us while we are here. Imagine going through life with two or three friends ready to help us and love us at every step and ignoring them. Woe did this very thing, and yet his guides did not stand in judgment of him. Such is the stuff that the love of God is made of. Woe began to get the picture and to feel that he had fouled up terribly. The guides, however, set him straight immediately. They told him, "Do not be reproachful with your spirit, for it is inappropriate and does not serve your magnificence." This was Woe's crossover. At that moment, he went from being a past human in lesson to becoming what he always was, a piece of God, a universal entity. The next thing he looked at was his real name on the door, and he remembered everything. When Cryon presents Journeys and Parables, he actually takes me there during the live translation. In the case of this parable, I got to feel the wind and the weather, and so forth. Cryon often lets me describe what I am seeing in addition to the thought groups given to me for translation. In the process, however, I am affected greatly, often weeping with the joy of full understanding of what is being presented while I sit in my chair. There is nothing that I can describe that is close to this experience in comparison, except what we get to feel in a very, very real dream. I actually stood there as Woe did, poised at the brink of going home, bathed in love. I felt the tug of love from those who were already there, and I longed for my friends on the other side. I saw my brilliant, glowing guides and felt their love, and then I took the hand of Cryon and returned to my chair in the gathering in Del Mar.
Jason and the Cave. Here's a story about a game that was played between Jason and the guardian of the Cave of Creation. It's a test of self-control for Jason, disguised as a simple challenge. Can you guess the correlation to our lives?
Jason had a vision. Actually, it was a dream, but in Jason's case, there was no difference. Jason was very enlightened, and he often had visions in his dreams. This one was especially vivid. Jason found himself at the opening of a great cave, and he instantly recognized what it was. This was the Cave of Creation, the site of the Akashic Records, where all the details are kept regarding human entities entering and leaving the planet. "Oh, I recognize this place," thought Jason to himself. Standing at the cave was the guardian of the entrance. He did not seem bothered that Jason was suddenly standing at the entrance. In fact, he was expecting him. The guardian spoke, "Jason, it is good to see you here. We have a puzzle for you, a test, a game for your soul." The guardian smiled, and Jason knew some fun was at hand. "This is wonderful," remarked Jason. "I love games." "Take a look at the path," said the guardian, as he effortlessly slid open the big door to the cave. Jason could see that there was a straight and narrow path through the cave. He could see at the other end of the cave that there was a light where the exit was. The cave was easily traversed. "What is the game?" Jason asked the guardian. "We would like you to walk through the cave to the exit, and we will give you 1 Earth hour to do so," said the guardian. "No problem," replied Jason. "What do I get if I succeed?" "This is not about reward. It is only in playing the game. There is great honor if you enter at all. Walking the path is the test, and making it to the exit is the goal. Can you do it? I'll succeed, said Jason, his sporting nature taking hold. And with that, the guardian stood aside, and Jason began his journey. Jason entered the cave. Again, he looked straight ahead and saw that the exit was no more than a quarter-mile journey straight ahead. Realizing he had plenty of time, he stopped for a moment to let his eyesight become accustomed to the subdued lighting within the cave. He moved forward and was interested in the many colors he was seeing. It was not long before Jason also began hearing sounds. To the left and to the right of him, he heard events taking place. Jason thought to himself, I have an hour. It's only going to take me 15 minutes to get to the exit, so I'll stop and investigate what I'm hearing. Jason stopped and turned to the right. Instantly, he saw a rack full of glowing crystals. He carefully left the path and went over to the interesting objects. On each one of the wand-like crystals, there was special writing. Jason gently grasped one, not picking it up. He was immediately taken to the event that the cryptic writing represented. Jason saw amazing things he never knew existed. He saw wars. He saw great conflagrations. He saw light against dark. He saw the names of so many entities. What an experience! He was actually there. Jason did not understand what he was seeing, but he marveled at the information and found it hard to release his grasp of the crystal. It was so compelling. Being mindful of the game and his limited time, Jason put the crystal down, still reeling with emotion at what he had just seen. Back on the path, he realized that his crystal-touching experience had only taken a few moments. It seemed like so much longer. He was well within his time parameter. Jason moved forward on the path again, but in not too long a time, he heard some voices, and he stopped. What voice is this? He said to himself. I recognize it. Jason realized that it was his mother's voice. He turned to the left and saw another group of crystals not too far from him. He moved over to the group and somehow recognized his mother's crystal, but with a name etched upon it that was unfamiliar. He stayed for a moment, trying to hear what she was saying, but he could not. It had been years since she had passed on, and yet here she was. Or was it only a crystal? Jason had a choice. He knew he wanted to touch his mother's crystal. Something else said it was too private to do. Jason rationalized. This is family, and she would want me to have her memory. Therefore, I'm going to touch it. So Jason touched the crystal, and immediately he was in the reality of the many lifetimes of his mother. And the Akashic records of her experiences on Earth unfolded before him. He saw the many lives she had and all of the years that she had spent on the planet and the years she had spent elsewhere, up to and including the one that he was in. Then he saw the one that she was in now as a child, that he was not a part of. It was fascinating, and he wept with remembrance and joy for her service. Oh, this is wonderful. What a game is this, he said aloud in the cave. And with some difficulty, he took his hand away, only to realize that the crystal next to it was his father's. And so Jason touched that as well. And he had a similar experience there, and he said again, this is wonderful. What a study this is. I am so honored. I am so honored. Time was now growing short. Jason knew he had to move on or he would not make it to the exit in time. So Jason started quickly down the path and proceeded to within a few feet of the exit when he heard another voice. And this time he recognized that it was his own. Jason turned to the right, and there was another crystal glowing. On this one, he recognized the name, for there was a private, spiritual name etched into the crystal in what looked to Jason like Arabic letters which spelled his astral name. Jason looked at the exit of the cave a few feet away, with full knowledge that he only had a few moments left. Then he looked up at his crystal and made up his mind. He simply could not pass up this opportunity. He turned to the right and touched the crystal with his name on it. Needless to say, Jason did not make it out of the cave in the allotted time for the game to be complete. He stayed there, reveling in his own past lives with great understanding of who he was and who he was supposed to be. He stayed there, reveling in his own past lives with great understanding of who he was and who he was supposed to be, with tremendous understanding of the overview of who his mother and father were in his past lives and who he was in their lives as well. And then Jason awoke. He thought, what a wonderful dream this has been. Then he remembered all of it. But I'm sorry I did not win the game, he lamented. So Jason went forward with his life, not understanding what the dream really meant, but feeling no judgment from the guardian. Occasionally he thought, if I could play it again, it would be different. I know the pitfall.
Many who read this little story feel that the path through the cave is a person's life, and that the exit is the end of life. Actually, Kryon's explanation is that the path is indeed life, but the exit represents illumination, self-realization, enlightenment, and a change in the future. Therefore, the parable represents a human being with a seemingly straightforward task. Walk the path from the start to the finish without spending too much time looking around, and you will get there. Really, there is much more information here. Kryon tells us that we are all exalted ones walking the planet, and that while we are here, we tend to feel the opposite and spend a great deal of time studying the past. I quote from Kryon Book 2, page 204. Kryon wants us to know that if the star player of the game becomes enthralled and stands motionless in awe of his teammates, that the game will never get played, much less won. We are to gather information as tools for our own action. We are never to study the members of our support group to the extent that it stops our own development. Past life regression is great, unless you tend to live in the past all the time. Studying the history of the metaphysical universe is enlightening, unless that's all you do. Kryon recognizes that there is more information available on these subjects than at any other time in the history of the world. And it's fascinating information, due to our new powers of discernment and intuition. However, if the goal in life is to discover our personal reasons for being here, to raise the vibration of the planet, and to move forward with self-realization, then we cannot spend all of our time looking at what was. What would you have done if you were Jason? Would you have stopped when you found your crystal? I know I would have. Sometimes the distractions are almost irresistible. I guess that's why God calls what we are doing work. This is a set of four stories based on four common fears. It is different from any other set of stories or parables in this book. It was a time when Kryon sat before a crowd in the seaside setting of Del Mar, California. In that crowd were four individuals whom Kryon honored by describing a past life setting or a past life experience. Sometimes the actual death of the person in a past life was given. The reason was to present us an example of how past life energy contributes to the karma of this life and help shape our personal lessons today. The stories are serious, and they are about real people who were there that evening. Prior to the stories, Kryon gives us a brief synopsis of how karma is carried and why it is there at all. Through all of this, Kryon invites us to see the incredible victory available through realization of the overview of our life's lesson. For that is the secret to passing quickly through these lessons and living a far more peaceful life.
The fear of abandonment. We speak to one of you tonight who has a real fear of being left behind, of being abandoned totally. Yet there is nothing in your current life that might have caused such a feeling. I invite you to remember something, something that will create emotion as well as understanding in your heart. You are 9 years old, dear one, a female, just like now. You awaken and find yourself a passenger in a small boat with 14 others, bobbing up and down on a calm sea. You inhale the salt air and feel the warmth of a rising sun on your face. This serenity is short-lived, however, as your brain races to try and remember why you are here. Slowly you recall, and your heart sinks with grief. Your last vision is that of being roughly carried out on deck in your parents' arms as a ferocious fire rages at their heels. They are almost at a dead run as you are clutched to your father's chest. You can smell the fear on his breath. You remember the sounds of screaming and yelling, the shouts of panic around you. You remember being flung into the air without your father even stopping at the rail. You fall a very long way into the calm ocean. After clearing the water from your eyes and recovering from the temperature change, your swimming instincts take over and you tread water for a short time until you are lifted into a small boat with the others. You look backwards at the large wooden ship, now totally engulfed in flames, and your parents are nowhere. They have saved your life, but it was too late to save their own. You look at the others in the small boat, adults, each one, and scream at them to do something. You see only the reflected yellow flickering in their faces and eyes as they too are in shock and horror at what they are seeing. They do nothing but watch. Slowly, the great ship slips into the sea as the smoke billows into the sunset, somehow increasing the beauty of the already red and yellow sky. There is a great hissing sound as the waters ironically douse the fire that was out of control. Then, there is nothing. Swirling bubbles mark the place where a comfortable life of love, anticipation, promise, and caring abruptly came to an end that evening. It is done. There are no tears. There is a moment, a flash, when you understand intuitively with your 9-year-old higher self that this is your contract, that this is the agreement you had with your parents. But the logical order and the spiritual appropriateness escapes you as you feel the incredible emptiness of the abandonment of love. The little girl has suddenly grown up, and the child has seemingly died. For a moment, there is the temptation to join them in the waters, the warm waters of this Baltic Sea. But suicide is not in the makeup of children. It only comes later with intellectualization, using the adult brain. The die is cast for this feeling and this scene to follow you lifetime after lifetime. For it is dramatic, and the lesson it carries must be looked at and realized. And so it is that you live your life with others around you, none of whom will ever show you the love that you received from these special parents. You feel as though you are in a boat of strangers for the rest of your life. You know who you are, dear one, in this group. For the attribute of karma that you still have before you is the fear of abandonment. It is not a logical fear in your life, because you have not experienced it here. But you fear it greatly. As a child in this life, you were a problem to your parents because you clung to them and would not let go. Even now, you call the remaining one twice a day just to see if she's okay. Relationships come and go because you simply cannot find it within yourself to trust that any partner will remain at your side. And you refuse to go through an unpleasant separation. Better to remain alone than that. The flames of the burning ship are imprinted on your DNA like stains on wood. and you live your life moving in and out of them, like weaving a web around a poison strand that can never be touched. Dear ones, we give you the invitation this night to pass through this karma. You see, there are those of you in this room, and even hearing these words, whose lives are controlled by the fear of abandonment. The windows of opportunity come your way to correct this, yet you do not go through them. It would mean taking an action that would stir up the fear, touch the forbidden strand, and you often feel controlled and don't know why. This is the way karma works. When these situations occur, we invite you to walk straight into them. The tool you now carry is the love of God in the new energy. This love is all around you. Your guides and angels stand beside you and hold your hands, whether you are in the most barren part of earth or the most populous. Feel this anointed love surround you. Claim it. Cross this painful bridge. Feel the love pour into you and know that abandonment is not in your program any longer. Feel the magnetic code dissipate as you free yourself from this phantom. And know that you are cared for by an energy that will never, ever abandon you. Your efforts will be rewarded with success, for this is the lesson, and the passing of it will raise your vibration and that of the entire planet.
There is also one among you who is fearful of any kind of confrontation. This will explain why. You are 32 years old, dear one, a male in this reflected lifetime. You are a female, however, as you sit here in this group. In this past life, you sit uneasily with others in the chill of night, waiting to stand and emerge in a line of battle. As you move, your armor feels uncomfortable, for you've never had it on before. The helmet, which is forced onto your head, feels foreign and is the wrong size. The shield is heavy, and the sword, you never realized how heavy a battle sword was. You are asked to stand, but you barely can due to the added weight. You are being placed into battle as a last-ditch effort to save your country. It is being overrun by the barbarians, the conquerors, the ones grabbing your land and taking all you own. The small army of your country was overcome weeks ago. Now you are being required by your leaders in a final effort to go before this enemy that advances upon you. Only 3 days ago, the stewards of government came and gathered you from your fields, for you are a farmer by nature and understand animals, crops, and plants. Now you stand next to those battle-clad with you in the lines, who are also farmers, for you all have worked with sheep and goats and livestock. And you stand with a heavy sword in your hand and realize that you don't know how to handle it, and that you don't begin to have the knowledge of the warrior you are about to face. You are afraid. Your body and brain yell, "Run the other way!" But you have the silent honor of the love for land and country, and so you sit, waiting. It is time. The sun is rising, and the sounds of the enemy come rolling over the fields with the morning dew. You peek over the trenches, and you see their lines advancing toward you, clanking and thumping with the machinery of war. The battle bell is sounded, indicating that you must rise and move forward. You look at the man next to you, a neighbor for years, one who grew wonderful crops, crops you have tasted many times at events with his marvelous family. And you see the fear and sorrow in his eyes. He avoids your stare lest you see his tears. Both of you simultaneously lift your heavy weapons and armor loads as you stand and advance toward the warriors in your path. There is no thought of fleeing, no thought of saying no to your land. The enemy will destroy your farm anyway, so you might as well die fighting them now. Oh, the smell of fear is in the air, dear one, as you march toward this noisy line, and you know that death is imminent. there is no turning back. You do not look in the faces of those next to you, those neighbors whom you have known and loved, those whose children you have known by name. For you know you will see their fear, and you wish to give them dignity in their last moments. As you approach the enemy, the warriors advance quicker. They are anxious to meet you. Somehow they know that their victory is assured. All too soon, they are upon you. You see the face of the one who is going to make battle with you. He sees you, and instantly he sizes you up. He knows you are a farmer, and he grins, revealing his missing teeth. All seems to be in slow motion as you wonder if he has ever helped birth a calf, or tend a flock, or raise a crop. Did he have a family, or perhaps nurse a sick animal through a rough time? He raises his axe high above his head, and you raise your shield instinctively to ward off his blow. With his other hand, he sinks his blade beneath your shield, deep into your flesh. He has tricked you with this basic warrior move, and with a searing pain in your gut, you immediately feel your legs weaken under you. It is quick and effective. He knocks you over with his shield and lets out a victory yell. You feel the spittle on your face as he speaks in a tongue you don't understand, and he moves on to his next victim. You smell the familiar dirt as you lie in the mud, listening to the large group retreat towards your farm. In preparation, your family is safe in hiding, and your animals have all been freed. Somehow, you are peaceful. It is over. You did all you could, and now it is up to the others. Goodbye, dear precious family. You hear yourself squawk in a voice that is seemingly not your own. I will see you all in God's time. It is over, and you know intuitively that you are going home. You feel the warmth of your life's fluid run out of you and spill on the land you love and have cultivated many times. The pain is brief. Then there is blackness. Dear ones in this room, let me tell you, this is why God loves you so much. For events like this create your lessons, and these are the lessons that raise the vibrations of the planet. Is it any wonder that we sit at your feet in awe that you have chosen to do such work? This painful event from a great past time speaks to you today, many lifetimes later, of your fear of confrontation. It also speaks to you of your hesitancy to join with your government in any venture, for it spelled death to you the last time. Please realize that you do not necessarily have to go through a battle with a toothless titan to have the fear of confrontation. But again, we have exemplified the most dramatic case this night so that all of you will appreciate who is sitting next to you. We encourage those of you who wish to move through this karmic fear of confrontation to put on the armor of God. The next time confrontation presents itself, in whatever form that creates fear in your body, which makes your heart beat faster or stirs the chemistry to make you anxious, move directly into it. Feel girded by the mantle of God. This new armor of the Spirit of God is far different than before, because the rules have changed in this new age. This is the age of co-creation with God, an age where your power is absolute as long as your intent is pure. This is the mantle of love and the sword of truth. There is nothing that can stand against it. Those on the other side of your new energy confrontation will absolutely be aware of your karmic change as you move into the event, and they will change too. Watch for it. See how their reactions will not be the same when you put on your spiritual armor and wield your sword of truth. For your actions will push love toward the individual you are confronting, and do more than just confront it. It will solve the battle without wounding the warrior. for it will change the one you are dealing with, and it will change you as well. No matter what kind of confrontational situation is at hand, move into it with confidence and love. Your confrontation is no longer a battle where there is always a loser and a winner, but instead, the confrontation itself brings about solutions for both. The mantle of God contains the armor of wisdom, the shield of knowledge, and the sword of truth. Move into it, therefore, with peace and a quiet countenance of assurance. When you do this, your karmic tie will be broken, and you will never again fear this attribute.
Almost all of you have had a lifetime that matches the one given now. Go with me for a moment into this lifetime. If we were to ask you to look down at your feet, you could see in the dim light of the corridors that you are wearing sandals, sandals that you made yourself. There are some of you who cannot even see your feet, for your stomachs are so large due to the fatness stemming from eating the bread that you are making in the monastery. Rumor has it that fasting was invented by the high priests just to keep the friars from exploding. You can be the judge of that. All of you have had lifetimes in service before God. We can tell you this because there is a commonality among those who are here before me in this group, searching for enlightenment, serious about sitting for an hour or so listening to my spiritual stories. It speaks of who you are and exemplifies your lives. But you see, there is something very interesting about this past life. For in service to God, the intent was indeed upside down. You have diminished yourself in service to God. Some of you, for more than one lifetime, you have groveled as sheep before your doctrine because you felt that it was your purpose and because you were told that this was necessary and instructed by God. Nothing could be further from the truth, dear ones. You come into this lifetime as enlightened beings with many colors showing with your greatness, showing how important you are in the scheme of things. We have already told you this, and this is why we wash your feet. So it does not serve your magnificence to spend lifetimes groveling in unlit passages as scribes before a Godhead. Why did this happen? How could good news of your arrival as honored humans from the image of God walking in karmic lesson be translated to such a scenario? Let me give you a hint as to how this could be. How this wonderful message of human honor and empowerment from the great New Age Master of Love could have been twisted so much. Think about this. For hundreds of years, your spiritual leaders were also your governments. They occupied the same seats and passed political and spiritual laws. What is it that men regularly do to create control? I will leave the question for you to answer, for it will show you why governors should never be priests. This upside-down worship is still rampant within your time now. Even though religion is no longer linked to your political leaders, listen to what your religious leaders tell you today. Does it really sound like the true message of human empowerment as the Master of Love intended? Modern-day religious leaders will still tell you that you are nothing, born into a world where you cannot win, a world where you have somehow already done some horrible things that you should be ashamed of. They say you have to put your trust and faith and your abundance in a doctrine. Then you can be something. This message, dear ones, does not suit your magnificence. This message, dear ones, is not accurate information. For you are indeed special when you arrive. So what karma is produced through lifetimes of monastery service? It produces fear and anxiety towards authority. It creates a feeling of unworthiness, and one where you feel you can do nothing that is good. You feel that only the higher spiritual ones can do anything at all. When you spend lifetime after lifetime being told you are nothing and that you are sheep, then you are in constant search of the shepherd, and you never feel that you are worthy to be the shepherd. Modern-day religious leaders tell you who the shepherd is, and most of them do not agree with each other. Still, they control you. They tell you what to do. They contain your enlightenment. This is wrong. It is a basic fear caused from eons of time spent misunderstanding who humans are. The master himself told you that you are shepherds in training and are equal. Read the words again. This karma keeps you away from your magnificence. It keeps you from walking through the windows of opportunity because you do not feel worthy of success. You often feel that you cannot do certain things and cannot have abundance while you walk this planet. Claim your power. God is your partner in this new age, and your intent should be to communicate and discern, not fall on your face and worship to the exclusion of doing the work. Our admonishment is that you pull out the mirror of the Spirit of God and look in it. See who you are. See the brilliant colors that you are. See the honor that is yours. Revel in it. You are indeed worthy, and the love and instructions of God will support this. God does not wish to control you.
The fear of enlightenment and commitment. The time is more than 4,000 years ago. You, dear one, are female and are in a marvelous procession. The parade started at the palace, and through several hours of winding down narrow streets, you are finally at your destination. Flowers are being thrown upon you, and all are shouting their praise for you. You are dressed in a long white flowing gown, trimmed with elegant gold taken from the mines hundreds of miles away. Other women march with you at your side, who look similar in their splendor. Although the crowd is adoring, you do not smile. The protocol is set, and there are ceremonial rules to follow. The procession plods along slowly to the beat of many drums from the musicians marching behind you. There is a large object being carried directly in front of you that leads the parade. It is heavy and has many servants to carry it. The desert air is stifling, and as normal, there is a hot wind blowing about this time of day. You do not care about the energy that you're exerting, for it will make no difference tomorrow. You move ahead, tired but alert. You feel honored, for among women, you are a spiritual leader. You and your fellow marching attendants are about to be honored above all the rest and receive rewards far in advance of any others around you. Slowly, the spectacle winds its way to the designated area where the parade stops. The drums drone on, however, and the musicians move to a place of height as they continue to drum and climb the stairs at the same time. Finally, they turn and face you from their high position. Then they stop. Nothing but the wind can be felt or heard. It's very hot. It has taken days to prepare you. Baths and oils and preparation work by the servants of the king have made you a work of art. Your face has never looked like this. It is radiant and colorful. Your hair has many ornaments. Gold and precious stones adore your neck and arms. The heaviness of it all is beginning to wear after the many long hours of travel on foot from the palace, but your pride does not let anyone know it. So here you are, poised at the entrance to the tomb of the pharaoh. You know what is next. There is a hush while the musicians start the song of the ascension. A plodding rhythm calls for you to walk very slowly. You and the others creep behind the sarcophagus and practice steps as you descend down the long ramp that will take you into the bowels of the prepared pyramid. More flowers are thrown. Incense is everywhere. And you slowly descend down the ramp toward the sunken entrance. As your troop marches down the gradual slope, the ramp walls give you some shade and coolness for the first time in many hours. And suddenly, you are inside. It's actually cool here. There's dampness and some water, and you slowly lose the sound of the crowd from outside. As you negotiate the tunnel, you move into single file, another practice move. Torches now light the way, and the last thing you hear from the outside is the muffled beating of the slow drums. Reverence is all about you, and the priests lead the way into the final room where you move into the ceremonial circle of eternal life and wait. You have never been within the actual pyramid. They never allowed it. All practice was done in the palace, within a room that was almost identical to another ceremonial circle. And now you know why. The gilded coffin is set into the great stone chamber, and the lid is lowered. The pharaoh's mechanics remove the ropes and fulcrums from the stone lid and quickly disappear the way you came in, almost running in their quest to leave. The priest gives the signal, and you take your place in the alcove with the stone seat. Another signal, and you sit. It feels good to sit, but still you do not smile. The priests take their places as well and remain silent. All is still, and then you hear it. A sound that very few have ever heard from your vantage point, and that none have ever lived to describe. It is a sound that you know will be one of the last that you hear as a human. The afterlife awaits, and the boats have been prepared not too far from you. There have been years of preparation, and yet there is something happening within you. Fear. Are the others feeling it? You're going to die now. This is real. The sound goes on for a very long time, distant as well as close-up rumblings of lids descending, doors being slid shut, stone after stone being lowered in place with hydraulics that only work one way. Once the sand is gone from the tubes, the stones are down. There's no way to raise them. No thieves will ever be able to penetrate the stone vault. The pharaoh's mechanics on the outside begin their work to erase the tunnels and build new ones to confuse anyone who would rob your precious chamber of its king. You know that long before the workers are finished sealing the tomb, you will be dead. The torches are slowly going out, and you realize that soon it will be pitch black. This is the last light your eyes will ever see. The air is becoming stale. You've never been afraid of being in confined places, but this is different. It's your coffin. Still you sit, but now you are shaking. You hear around you mild whimpers and sobbing, and you realize that you're not alone in your horror and fear. It was all fine and good to be within the spiritual entourage of the pharaoh, but you really didn't expect this day to ever come. You thought that he would grow much older before he died. Instead, his death came so soon. You knew that those around him would go with him to his grave, including you, but it was all such a fantasy, something in the future. You committed yourself to a spiritual quest and stood as a leader in the pharaoh's court for years, and now you are almost in the dark in a small room that will never have air or see the sun again. You fight the panic of it all. You can't get out. It's getting hard to breathe. It's dark. As as if knowing what you are thinking. A priest gets up. You barely see him working in the dimming light. He kneels and takes leaves out of his pouch and mashes them together on the stone floor. The light is almost gone. He takes the remaining smoldering torch and lights the leaves. You see more light as the leaves catch fire in their small pile on the floor. Briefly, you catch a glimpse of the others in their alcoves. Some are wide-eyed and filled with terror. You smell a sweet fragrance, and you know what it is. How humane, you think. No one told us of this. Thank you, dear sacred one. You send thoughts to the priest as you sense a feeling of escape. You breathe deeply of the smoke of the leaves, and you feel lightheaded. A few more deep breaths, and you lose consciousness. There is no more anxiety. The drug has put you to sleep so that you may pass from life into death without caring. Finally, there is a smile on your face, and that's the way the thieves will find you when they finally cut through the stone to steal the treasures from your arms and neck, the ones that your king selected to take into eternity with him. Dear ones, you have just witnessed the death of the entire attendant group around a great pharaoh, for this was the way of things. When the pharaoh died, his spiritual attendants went with him to the tomb so that he would have the same aids around him when he went into his afterlife. There's one of you here in this group who fears commitment and enlightenment so greatly that you will literally run the other way before you decide to seek God again. You are uncomfortable right now, and you remember that to get close to any spiritual intent is to die. Never let it happen again, shouts your innermost being. Your karma is set. Spiritual commitment equals death. It's time for you to change. Again, the love of God will temper your fear. It's time for you to metaphorically re-enter the tomb, for this time there will be no closure of it. This time you may pass through it to continue living on earth. God asks you to consider giving intent for full enlightenment this very moment. Join the group of attendants around the King of Kings, but this time live a grand life of your own while on the planet. No horrible premature death will take place if you decide to do this, and your karma will be broken. Listen to the voice of love as it speaks to you now, and know that these feelings never have to visit you again. Never again fear the spiritual path, for hiding in the phantom of your karmic fear is the energy of home. And so it is.
These stories were especially potent for the attendees that night. There was great silence in the room after Kryon finished. The faces of those listening to these words showed that some of them related to the scenarios, even though they were not the actual people being highlighted by Kryon. So many of us have walked through similar situations in past lives that these stories tend to reawaken some dim and distant feelings. And for a moment, the part of us that is God and knows all things resounds with the truth of who we really are and what we have been through. Some of us incarnate in groups, and therefore many of those listening that night may have actually been there and experienced the same events in other ways. In Kryon's words, it is again said, "With all of this, is it really any wonder that God loves you so?"